Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here tonight with our co-host, Red Beckman. Red will be joining us shortly, a little bit later in the show. I'm sure Dr. Kate will also be joining us, too. She's out trying to find a lost pup this afternoon, but she will be here eventually. Also, we'll be simulcasting tonight with Crusade Radio, and I'm sure that Doug Millar and Jim Cook will be on with us just as soon as they get signed into their station. And we always open this show with a prayer, and since I'm the only host here at the moment, I will open us. Please join me. Almighty Yahweh, Father, Creator, the true source of truth, the only self-existent one, we come before you tonight, and we ask that you you help us be our best in this show tonight. We want to be a part of your will. We always invite your spirit to be with us. We ask you to give a strong message to our guest tonight. Open the hearts and ears and minds of our listeners. And we pray that we can bring a message to them that will fill them up and answer some questions. And we just thank you for this opportunity to share tonight and strengthen us, please. And we pray all of this in the name of your son, Yahshua HaMashiach. Amen. Well, Red, I see you're on. Do you have a live mic, Red, or have you got yourself muted?
Yeah, I was muted, but I'm on now. Can you hear me?
And I'm yes, I do, and I just gave our other host tonight, we're simulcasting with Crusade Radio, and the guys over at Where Angels Fear to Tread, Doug Millar and Jim Cook. Guys, you've got a live mic, too. You want to say hello, and Doug, you might want to introduce our guest tonight, since you're quite familiar
okay.
with his work.
Yes, good evening, folks. This is Doug Millar, and my co-host, of course. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Doug. How are you tonight?
Fantastic. We're looking forward to a very powerful evening. And so I just want to tell you folks that I've had the privilege of actually meeting Jeffrey Smith. And of all things, I called Willis Carto in in 2010. I had a friend, Kenny Rhodes, who was kind enough to offer me, I never met him before, he offered me a round-trip ticket, also Ted Gunnison, a round-trip ticket, to fly from California to New York, round-trip, to speak at the President's Commission on human rights violations in Manhattan Beach. I'm sorry, Manhattan, financial headquarters of America. And Ted was dying of cancer. He had a powerful upsurge about 2.5 months before he died. So he called back and said, "Hey, I decided I'm going to feel great. Let's do it." So Kenny Rhodes did a ticket also. But then, of course, Ted was dying and he couldn't make it. But Kenny Rhodes is a hero of all things. He not only offers a ticket, he offers a all expenses paid event there. So,
hey, Doug, you're fading out and you're getting drowned out by Jim's bird back there. So we gotta get that bird quiet.
Hey, Jim, put it on mute, please.
put on mute. Jim.
Well, let me go ahead and jump in here because you're kind of fading on us, Doug. Jeffrey Smith is the is with the Eastern Bureau of American Free Press, and he's written on a lot of controversial topics. Some of the top ones that I've seen articles related to the UN Arms Trade Agreement, but we are very proud and pleased to have Jeffrey Smith with us tonight. Jeff, would you give us a little bit of history on yourself and let our listeners know who you are. You know, there's another Jeffrey Smith out there that's rather famous as well, and you're not him, so maybe we need to make sure the folks know that.
Well, my name is Jeffrey Smith. I'm based here in New York City. I became active essentially in 1965 in the patriotic community. I have been active in, goodness, let's see, the Wallace campaign back in the old days, New York State Conservative Party, to a certain extent, the National Alliance when it first started. I got involved. I was one of the founders of the TFP, Tradition, Family, and Property, the Catholic group in the United States. I've been deeply involved in, number one, I guess, I'm most aligned with the Liberty Lobby sector of the patriotic community, and which is sort of nationalist, and it is libertarian to a lesser extent. It's constitutionalists. I've been involved with constitutionalist organizations, but basically, I have a sort of, you know, after years and years and years, I've been involved in almost every patriotic organization I can think of that in some ways has been active in New York or the New York region or nationally. I mean, I've had very great luck in having worked for and worked with some of the most important patriotic people that have graced this country. Many of them, unfortunately, have passed on to their well-deserved rewards, and we continue, unfortunately, to spiral down. However, the thing is that I've basically been involved in a very wide number of organizations. It seems like I've been around forever now. Age catches up on you to a certain extent, but I've been around since the 60s.
Yeah, Fred, I know the feeling on age gets to you, but, my co-host, Red Beckman, I don't want to talk too much about age because Red, what are you, 86 now?
No, I'm still 85. Don't rush it.
Well, Red's been a great supporter, Jeffrey, of American Free Press, and I don't know how well you guys are acquainted, but Red turned me on really as a subscriber to American Free Press, and we've had folks like Pat Shannon on the show in the past, and we very much appreciate American Free Press and what they're doing there. It's one of the few places where you can go and get the truth, and that seems to be less and less a shrinking thing these days.
Well, that's exactly true, and the thing is that it's one of the few publications that the other side can swallow. Now, understand that what I do is I take the publication and I put it in windshields around the United Nations. I've had federal agents chasing me down the street. What are you giving out? What are you giving out? You know, I will go up into the Upper East Side where the NGOs and non-governmental organizations that basically run the country are, you know, and the people that basically see, that's one of the major problems here, that most policy is being generated extra-governmentally. It's either being generated, you know, on the Upper East Side of Manhattan or in London, okay, because the British have too much of a reach into this country. Very few patriots around the country understand this unless you're here in New York and you see the liaison between these internationalist organizations and the major banks here, and the banks in London, and the various figures in their NGO community over there. More about that later. But the thing is that essentially we give out, you know, you can jump up and down. The reason why I'm active here in New York is you can jump up and down on the arm of a giant, and he'll just flick you off. If you jump up and down on his eyeball, he's got to stop whatever he's doing, you know, and pay attention to you and cease what he's doing until he deals with you. And so the thing is that it's important to be at a nerve center. And I know you can give out all the conservative void literature you want. They don't care about that. They don't care about that because that's not a serious threat, you know. You've got to have something that has an element in it that is such poison that they can't swallow, because you can't use aspirin on cancer, you know. There was a great religionist here in New York. There have been many great religionists of all stripes here in New York, but the thing is, through the years, and some of the worst in the world, obviously, the condition of the country is largely a result of that. However, what happened, they had a major role in it. But the thing is that they had a Catholic figure called Bishop Fulton Sheen, and he had his own program on TV called Life is Worth Living in the 50s. He became quite a major figure. He was very media-oriented. But prior to World War II, they had a boycott of German goods, okay? And what happened to these characters here in New York, and they went to leader after leader getting them to sign, you know? And they came to Bishop Fulton Sheen, and he said, you know, they're saying what's going on in Germany. And he said, wait a minute here. You've got rats, meaning the communists. This is rat poison. Rat poison isn't a pleasant thing, but if you've got rats, you need rat poison, you know? And they tiptoed away from him. But they never got that rat poison remark out of their craw, you know? So even in the 1980s, when people would talk about him, certain kinds of people, they would spit that up. You know, but the thing is, that's the whole thing. You need to produce something that they can't ingest and they can't digest. You know, it's something that is such a contradiction, it's such short circuits them that they can't tolerate it. Okay, and it really drives them crazy, and it also makes them make mistakes. It drives them to such a state that they do make visible mistakes, and that's a major opportunity for us. And there are only a few publications that I really dealt with through the years that either have such a beneficial effect that they change minds irreversibly, where the minds never go back to what they were before, and the other thing where they do irreversible damage to the other side, or there's such a poison and a counteractive to the other side that it that truly disrupts the other side. And the spotlight and later the American Free Press actually does that. It truly disrupts them in a wonderful way. So the thing is that that's why I represent it and I deal with it and I spend time writing in it, you know. But again, there are two types of producers. The nearest analog to what we do is actually, in my mind, the nearest analog are small record companies, right? You're sitting in Sun Records in the 1950s, small label, okay? How do you affect the world? Well, they shook the world for better or worse, I think for worse in lots of ways. But the thing is small record labels, you're sitting there. You've got to put out something that makes people want to buy the record, all right? And other people hear the record and buy copies themselves. You've got to have something that motivates people to buy and then will motivate people to give it to somebody else. Hey, listen to this, okay? You've got to get into the public consciousness. And then there are two tests in literature. Number one, how much does it get into the public consciousness? And number two, what do you motivate people to do? You know? And the thing is that those are the two tests. And my writing and all the things we do are measured on those two things. How can we get into the public consciousness, and how much damage, irreversible damage, can we do to the other side? And there are some publications that are that way, you know, through the years. And there are other problems. And the other thing that's important to understand is how many, you know, think about this. Think about how many albums did Mantovani, you know, the famous Italian band leader in the 1950s and 60s and early 70s, how many albums did he sell for London Records? Hundreds of millions. He made gazillion dollars from London Records, okay? I don't know anybody in the last 20 years who knows or cares that he ever existed. But I'm going to tell you right now, tonight, without doubt, there is going to be 200 front singers are going to get in front of 200 bands around the country. And you know what they're going to go to the mic and say? They're going to say the famous words, the night's so young, 12 o'clock, you know, and they're going to start screaming out classic rockabilly, okay? And people do care about that. Why? Because it changed the world. Again, for the better or for the worse. So the nearest analog of what we do is a small records label. We have limited resources, and we've got to do damage with the limited resources. And how do we do that? You know, and the thing is that, again, there are two types of people. There are two types of writers at American Free Press. There are the album makers and the hit makers. Look, without albums, every label would go out of business, okay, because you need that steady money. But the way people view a label and the way they view its products is the hits that it's made, the quality of the hits, the sound that this label represents. It's got to be distinctive, it's got to be different, and it's got to get into people's heads, you know. And the thing is that's really the way things actually work. You know, we're a small record label, so we've got limited response, and we've got to, like a laser. But there are other guys who have got to lay down a broad pattern of background. Okay, these are two critical functions. Every hit maker thinks that the album guys on the label are Dullesville. You know, all the album guys think that the hit makers are erratic and unreliable, and they wouldn't introduce, they don't want to do it anywhere near them, you know, that kind of thing. But without both of those types of products, the label can't exist, and it can't advance, you know, and it can't advance the music. So the thing is that's what we have. We have people that crank out news continuously, reliably, high-quality news, okay? And then you've got people like me, and I'm a hit maker, you know. I'm looking to get into something that is absolutely going to change. It's going to get into public consciousness, and it's going to change the basic parameters of people's heads, you know. And the Mexican story, the Mexicans patrolling Staten Island, Mexican government thought they were going to put Mexican cops and Mexican military patrolling Staten Island because there were so many illegal aliens over there, and they're getting beaten up by the black kids. Right? So first of all, media spun it that the white kids were doing it, right? Then it ended up where it was obvious it was the black kids and some Latin kids are beating up the Mexicans over there. And the thing is that there's some Chinese gangs got involved over there, finally. And finally, so they had the bishop in New York went over there and tried to call on the situation, and he made it worse. He had basically ineffective. So we went over there, we did a very major story, which you can pull off on YouTube. Jeffrey Smith, Mexican Staten Island, just Google that, then it'll come right up. And the thing is that it's stories like that that basically change, you know, there was a howling match. Of course, the wonderful John Birch Society, our wonderful friends, decided to attack me and attack the American Free Press. You know, they couldn't stand by and see that. But the thing is that other people were using the R word about the whole matter. But the thing is that now that's what you do, basically. You have to put out stuff that basically sets a new standard, you know, or opens a new area. I mean, what's happening now, there are these two lawsuits, one in New York and one in D.C., and what they're seeking to do is they're seeking to sue the board that does the London Gold Fix. You know, twice a day you get these characters in London that largely arbitrarily set the price of gold. Yeah, and they used to meet at the Rothschild office doing this and raise little Union Jacks, you know, to vote for a price of gold. And the thing is that they do that twice a day. Well, there's a lot of charges of manipulation, you know. Never mind the suppressing the price of gold. Nobody wants to talk about that, you know. But the thing is that still these two lawsuits are very, very, very significant. What may be dredged to the surface in the discovery process, or the whole thing may be suppressed, you know. But this is the most significant legal action against the London establishment and the Federal Reserve establishment, probably since GATA, you know, the Gold Anti-Trust Association, their legal action against the Fed. And you see what they did. They targeted the gold swaps, which is one of the most secret parts of the Federal Reserve's operation, where they, you know, they loan gold to foreign countries, then the foreign countries carry out all kinds of intelligence stuff, including renderings, by the way, which is illegal under U.S. law. It funds things that U.S. agents absolutely can't do, okay? And this has been going on for years. And the thing is, they finally got into that, and they did an FOI, and of course, they were refused. It was all accused. They sued, and they didn't get the information, but the judge examined it in camera, you know, and that's the first little crack, you know, and that's what you do in any criminal organization. Of course, you open little fissures in their wall of solidarity around them, or secrecy around them. And the thing is that, but this gold thing about the gold fix and who sets the gold fix, you know, and this whole thing that it should be set outside of the United States in London, and why is that? Well, it's always been that way, you know. Well, now these two lawsuits are seeking to look into that. The Deutsche Bank, you know, and they had that executive kill himself while, you know, Deutsche Bank, apparently the German government investigative arm went after them looking at their app practices. Now it looks like they're trying to withdraw from the board. You know, they're one of the five members. You know, this is a significant story that's going on that's very, very deep. Who knows what's really going on with that, but it's shining a light on a very sensitive point in the system, which is what we want. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing you want to target. That's what hit makers do, okay? Album makers are a different story, but you absolutely need both to have the kind of publication that is going to do damage to the enemy and is going to have sustainability.
Well, we talked the other day when we were visiting on the phone about how difficult it is to break through, you know, the dumbed down thinking and the spoiled nature, if you will, of the American people. And you mentioned that, you know, if you want to get a message out there, you better write a song about it, because that's going to reach more people than all of the truth that you can write, really.
Right.
And I thought that was,
yeah,
interesting.
Poker Face and these other guys are wonderful. Music is, you know, I often say music is medicine to people who are sick or ailing. That's absolutely true. It's vibrational medicine. But it's also a very, very powerful agent for change. And our enemies know that. You know, and here in New York, there always was the political communists and there were the cultural communists. Okay, and the Communist Party absolutely had a wing that had no political activity whatsoever. They just did cultural, you know, and they got into museums, and they got into art, and they also got into music. And the thing is that they were infested the music world, and of course they both, you know, when I was a kid, I had a musical teacher that said, at one time the Locrian meter was considered the devil's meter. You know, and the thing is that that's, of course, true. There have been hundreds of studies. I mean, psychoacoustics is an old discipline. It's been around since, I don't know, the 1870s, and it was very valid. There is a clear, discernible effects, and responses to audio stimulation, especially music. Music is a very important modifier of a psychiatric state, and it also, of course, gets into people's heads, and it's just a wonderful manipulative tool. And but it can be used for bad, but it also can be used for good. And often, as you said, the patriots have not understood the value of music and the value of art. It's just been the political thing. But our enemies know darn well that they have to move on the political and the cultural level. So the thing is that certainly that's a lesson that increasingly we should know. And locally, as your theme song is telling, okay, because theme songs like that, that have a message like that, are critical for us getting into the public consciousness.
Well, as we also discussed the other day, you were talking about people needing to focus on New York and London instead of Washington.
Okay.
And I shared with you that, you know, the battles we've had here in Colorado regarding the anti-gun legislation, we were really fighting Bloomberg because he's the one that was threatening the Democrats out here and telling them that he was going to pay for their next primary opponent if they voted against any of that legislation. And when we went to the recall elections, the first thing that happened was that the ones that we were recalling got donations from Bloomberg to fight the recall. And I was fascinated by your depth of your knowledge of, you know, the city of London. You mentioned to me a couple of books, Empire of the City by E.C. Knuth and Union Jack by Anonymous. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that? I think you're dealing with a group that's probably got a fairly extensive understanding of where the head of the snake is, but I think this is pointing the finger directly toward the head of the snake, and we don't get that much from the mass media, if at all. Occasionally we do, but they just like even the gold manipulation, they came out and told us that there was going to be prosecutions coming down months and months ago regarding the manipulation of the metals market, and I haven't seen anything happen with that. It just seems like all of those stories get buried, and I appreciated your focus on that. So if you could share a little bit about your research on that, that'd be good.
Well, basically there are two books that have achieved, I guess, the summer of the patriotic community, of all the books that have come out. Now, certainly the basic syllabus or the basic structure of the books that every patriot should have and read and understand were always distributed by the Christian Book Club. They still are. But the thing is that that was Mr. Serpico, and his son is now carrying forward the work. But the thing is that these were basically books like Light Bears in the Darkness and, you know, all the Enter Within books, Inquire Within books. However, there are two books that have achieved the highest respect in the patriotic community among the old deep patriots. And the first one is called Empire of the City by E.C., E as in Edward, C as in Charlie, Knuth, K-N-U-T-H, E.C. Knuth, K-N-U-T-H. And that's Empire of the City. What that basically is about the old city of London. It's the banking compound. It's also called Threadneedle Street. It's the financial Vatican that's inside London, because the Lord High Mayor of London is not a British subject. Okay, in some ways the Queen, even though she's the wealthiest woman in the world, in some ways is an employee of the banks, because once they let these bums back in from Amsterdam, forget it, within 2 years they own the country. Of course, what do you think? And the thing is that, you know, all the predictions about in 200 years these guys would own America and we'd be serfs on the land, it's basically come true. Well, Empire of the City was written by a U.S. serviceman, as far as I know, in 1947. It certainly was published in 1949. And it's one of these books that created a fundamental shockwave in the patriotic community in the world prior to 1955. Now, you have to realize that in 1955 was a bellwether year, because that's when the powers that be, or someone, decided that they had to have a control mechanism. They had to have a contain and control structure to keep patriots contained and controlled and useless and out of power channels, okay? And what they did basically is, out of thin air, they invented conservatism, which didn't exist prior to 55, okay? And actually, if you think about it, it's the right wing of the One World Movement, all right? All these free traders that think that that people around the world should work for 3 cents an hour or less, and we should have goods here, and that's just great for them and the investor class. And if you end up with 500 to 1,000 miles of rusting factories in the Midwest, that's just fine. Okay, and I've had major conservatives, including William F. Buckley, and with his wonderful CIA background, argue that with me, you know. William Rusher, and a whole series of that National Review crowd. Now, the thing is that, so, they invented conservatism. And after that, there were three major elements in the so-called patriotic movement, which was Buckley, the Birch Society, and the Liberty Lobby. Now, there were many other semi-independent groups, but they tended to coalesce through those three channels, two of which were absolute straight conservatism. And what happens is that what all they did was they kept the movement contained and controlled in such a way that it had almost no effect. And it had some effects. Bob Depew and the Minutemen did great work. They were early survivalists. They turned everybody on to the necessity of being careful and being prepared and that kind of thing. It was very good. There were many very worthwhile things that went on. But overall, we spiraled down, and we continued to spiral down, especially after 1970 when the money became worthless. And we've been in free fall ever since, you know. Of course, now we're getting close to the bottom of the cavern, and there's going to be a nasty impact soon or sometime. But the thing is that so that's the whole thing. The other book that I mentioned to you was called The Union Jack, U-N-I-O-N, then Jack, J-A-C-K. And, of course, the Union Jack is the British flag. And that was written by anonymous, but, of course, everybody believes that it was written by Helen Peters, or either Helen Peters or Elizabeth Dilling. And the thing is that, God rest both their souls, and the thing is that these were very great people. And, you know, I used to get on the phone and call Mary Davidson and Mary Kane, you know, and talk to them at length, you know. And there was a women's B group, women whose husbands had been involved in the Bilderbergs or Bilderberg support groups. And after the guys died, they realized pretty much what they were doing, and they organized to try to undo some of the damage their husbands had done. They were based up in Connecticut, for example. But the thing is that, I would say that. Now, when I mentioned to you about, elements or political things that essentially or devices, that the patriotic movement has produced. And I said to you that there is some things that the other side cannot absorb, that are such violent poison. They are such strong poison to the other side that it drives the other side crazy. It drives them into an apoplectic state. Well, there is one other thing I want to mention off the top, which truly drives people crazy, and everybody should really become very aware of this. I have distributed all kinds of literature in New York, most of it is either laughed at or just passed over. But there are some stuff that they don't laugh at and they don't pass over, okay? Obviously, American Free Press. Obviously, things like the Union Jack. Obviously, things like the Union Jack, because it goes too close to that whole British Israel crowd, okay? Because that's, see, there's a large drive element inside the internationalist community, besides the people that say the world is overpopulated, and, you know, besides the transhumanist crowd. Those are kind of Johnny-come-lately elements or threads in this thing. But actually, there are older threads that drive it, and one of them, of course, is British Israel. It's this whole, which was the driving force behind the formation of the British Empire. This whole idea that when the tribes of Israel broke up, one tribe went to Britain and became, and each tribe had a certain area that it had biblical injunction to rule over, and Britain has a right to rule of everything from Britain over to the Ural Mountains and up to sort of southern Norway and the north of Africa. And, of course, that takes in all of Europe. Now, of course, you could say it to the French. They were shattered in the Revolution. You could say it to the Belgians or, who knows, you know, Luxembourgs. You know, you're not going to say it to the Germans. My goodness, Christianity didn't root very deeply in Germany in the first place. They don't want to hear that Britain has a right to rule over all Europe because they're a lost tribe of Israel. And boy, there's people that up and down believe this. Old, some of the old families, when I was a kid, the elite families here, the Pilgrims, all believe that, you know. Well, anyway, the thing is that there is a book and a person that, you know, really I want to mention, because it is a person and a publications house that truly causes the other side to go into apoplexy, okay? And the gentleman's name is Richard Kelly Hoskins, H-O-S-K-I-N-S. He is one of the most marvelous people that has really truly come out of the post-war right wing, or even pre-war. And the thing is that he's just about, you know, he's just one of the last legendary ultra leaders of the patriotic movement. And his publication house is called the Virginia Publishing Company. And he became originally known, he became known for many things, but he became known for a book essentially called War Cycles and Peace Cycles, okay? And as I said, then he follows it up, you know, he followed it up with a number of books on portfolio investment advisory, and he was the Hoskins Report for many years on the financial things that were going on, how bad the financial things were going on, and the kind of consequences they were going to have for this country, given the people who are financially running the country. But the thing is that finally he wrote a book called Vigilantes of Christendom, The Phineas Priesthood, and which is truly the cross to Dracula of these leftist characters here in New York. It's amazing the disruptive effect that these people have. And as I remember, let me see, the Virginia Publishing Company is out of a P.O. Box, 997 Lynchburg, Virginia, 24505. And anyway, but the thing is that if you just go into any Google and look for Richard Kelly Hoskins, of course, do this from somebody's house you don't like or somebody else's terminal, naturally, you know, but to any of these things. But what happens is that that's what I found truly is something that they kind of swallow and has a violent disruptive effect on many of these characters, you know. And, of course, it depends on how you introduce it. It depends on where you, you know. I mean, all these things, all these distribution needs very great skill in the way it's distributed and where you distribute it, you know. And so it's, you need the right product, you know. But it's like, again, it goes back to a record label. You may have a great band, you get a great singer, you get a great producer, you produce a great record, right? But if you don't distribute it exactly the right way, you got a dud, you know? And there's thousands of records on YouTube now that are fantastically good records that sold 20 copies. Yeah. So the thing is that it's a skill. When your country's in trouble, nothing beats the street, you know. But it's not the only thing, you know. But when you get on, put out stuff in the street and get into public consciousness the right way and motivate people to effective action, it's got to be presented just the right way. And in that terms, I don't know, things like color, things choiceable, graphic design, topography, all of that. It's, you know, the physical design is as important as the written message. It's a sad thing to say, but people have always been that way. You know, you can say the moon is made of green cheese and the right typeface, and people will start ascribing veracity to it. You can say there's air molecules all around us, and you use the wrong typeface, wrong paper, whatever. People will start questioning this concept. So the thing is that presentation is extremely critical in this matter. But it's also the fact that it's the album makers versus the hip guys. The thing is that, yes, you need people who are doing continuous, effective grassroots action. But you also need the shock troops to really get out there and shock the public into realizing what's going on. But you need both efforts, okay? And inevitably, both sides look at each other askance, but you've got to have both of those things to have an effective patriotic movement. So the thing is that what you're telling me about Colorado, that's exactly the kind of grassroots action you need, that there is retaliation, there is effective countermeasures and effective retaliation against the wrong kind of actions coming into your state. But you also have to have guts. See, at one time in this country, there was at times a very effective thing. It was done correctly, and that was called the right-wing picket. Every town of any size had in the 1950s and 60s had the right-wing picket. Okay, the guy had his table out, and he's giving out literature, you know. And, of course, the local press and the local establishment effectively usually depicted him as being crazy or a lunatic or a fringe person and this kind of thing. Really? Fine. How many people do you think came up and took the literature and the wheels started going around their heads? And how many people started poking on or really enjoying the stuff as a high, you know, and they read it as a jolt? And the thing is that, and that's why later in the 70s, you could make arguments to crowds and you'd have people in the crowd that weren't exactly hostile, because if things got worse in the 70s, you know, then a lot of people turned around and said, gee, you know, the guy was right. Well, the thing is that had the right-wing pickets been out there in numbers like they were, and their persistency was, you know, it was the most important thing, but also had they been persistent with a little better literature, a little better written literature, better presented, you know, the thing is that they would have done very, very grievous damage. So, you see, constancy of public availability is important. Reactivity in real terms is very important, just as you said about what you did in Colorado is wonderful. But you also have to have someone screaming bloody murder publicly about Bloomberg. You know, and the thing is that Bloomberg and his agents went all over this country with the anti-gun thing. He strutted around, and first of all, two things. There wasn't enough, if they did this in a left wing, there'd be huge puppets in the streets in his likeness, you know, and people would be throwing things, there'd be huge street demonstrations about this, you know. Well, the thing is that there was none of that. He was able to get away with it. But the second thing is, what happened with him is indicative of what's been happening in this country for the last, 100 years or so, okay, where you have a bunch of, well, you're luminous, or secret society people sitting here in New York firing missiles into, I don't know, Pascagoula or, you know, Oklahoma or Arkansas or wherever. And the thing is, if firing missiles into your home areas, what they're doing is they're disrupting your life in the area. They're making new rules for you in your area. And you know why they're doing that? Because they're very, very sure that you're too stupid to fire missiles back at them. So now they have a little safe island called Manhattan Island, okay? And also London. And what are they doing? They're firing missiles at you. They're disrupting your life. They're changing all the rules. They're bankrupting you, all right? And by the way, if they keep going, what's happening in this country, I mean, you're going to have an economic situation far worse than what happened in Greece. But you better pay attention to what happened in Greece, because people ended up having former middle-class people in very nice suits. What happened? They're eating out of dumpsters. Go into Google Photos and look at this, folks. Well, that's what far, far worse could happen here, given what's wrong here. But, see, all these things are happening, again, because it is not effective local defense, but also because they know from their experience that they can do any kind of outrage they want, and there's never, ever a penalty. There's never a personal penalty. There's never an institutional penalty. These banks in New York financed the Russian Revolution. They financed the rise of communism. Well, there's 130 to 140 million people dead as a result of the banks in New York and the banks in London, period. There is a Captive Nations Committee. There's two of them, the national and the original law, which is based here in New York. And the thing is that they hold a meeting every year. They hold the Captive Nations Week, which is a commemorance of how many people were killed. But the national organization put up a statue in Washington, D.C., and they had to fight every committee, commission, and board in Washington for 11 long years to be able to do this, even to have a moderate-sized statue in the back streets of Washington, D.C. Thankfully, it's near the State Department. I'm glad. I hope they see it someday. But the thing is that this is a statue, and around the base it says 100 million. Do you know why that is so? Because that's the figure at which every academic would never dare to challenge. If you get above that, then some academics start quibbling, and they start murmuring, and they start fighting with each other, okay? But when you get down to the 100 million figure, they absolutely know they all have to shut up. They know they have to shut up because they know that's where the evidence floor is. They can't get past that. Okay, so that means, let's argue that. Let's say the banks in New York, as a result of this, from 1917 until the so-called collapse of communism, let's say that only 100 million were killed. Okay? This is the worst killing spree in history. And this couldn't have gone on one day without constant access to Western bank credit, period. Because the Soviet Union is a negative cash flow society. It needs money to stay afloat, external money, right? Now, you'd think after 100 million people, and you know, the stories that people used to show up at the Captive Nations Day here in New York and tell the stories of what happened before they escaped from communism, okay? Where a kid would come home and the Soviet troops would come in, the father would tell him to hide in the basement, he'd hear gunfire, he comes up and he had to climb over the bodies of his whole family and escape, right? Other people had parents taken away or children taken away they never saw again. And these were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people through the years I spoke to who had these horrific stories. Well, to doing all those crimes, guess what? Zero of the people who perpetrated it, then or now, has been punished, ever. okay? There's nobody looking for them. They're not looking over their shoulders, all right? Listen, I live in Brooklyn Heights, one of the basic British bases in America. And by the way, that's true. The British have several communities in America that they activate whenever they want something, like they want America to get into a world war. And the thing is that, or they want America to stay out of something. And the thing is that it's interesting that there are people in my area who are the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of the people that financed the Russian Revolution. All this money that came through the American International Corporation, fine. How many of these monsters, and believe me, they were monsters, okay, and the kids are monsters too. Just get in a room with them. Forget about it. The thing is that they're all meeting up at the book club, for example, or all these other clubs they inhabit in Manhattan. Fine. How many of these people have suffered a personal penalty for their actions? Zero. So that's why they're spreading around doing all this stuff, guys, because Bloomberg is very safe up at 79th Street. People want to cry to me about how bad things are around the country. I always ask the same question. How many of you held one sign for 1 hour in front of the Council on Foreign Relations or the American Friends of the Bilderberg or the Trilateral Commission or the Club of Rome or the Association of the United Nations and on and on and on and on, okay? The thing is zero, all right? When you have this thing over at the United Nations where they put in this international gun control, all right? The thing is that you'd think there'd be thousands of people in the streets around the United Nations screaming bloody murder. But you see, among these gun groups, it's very interesting. There's an unwritten rule. Nobody bothers New York, all right? And you can never get the leaders to talk to that. Why they don't have their members show up whenever there's something at the United Nations. There's a hands-off the United Nations and hands-off New York, all right? Why is that? Well, you can't get any patriotic leader to tell you why that is. All right? They get very quiet and they change the subject. Try it yourself. Ask yourself. The United Nations is paid. You know, they couldn't get the countries to agree on the thing. So then they just went to the General Assembly and passed it in the General Assembly. Fine. How many anti-gun control activists showed up there? Okay? The largest group that I saw there was from the Muzzle Loaders Association. There was like five guys. That was it. There was a smattering of other people, a very nice smattering, that went to some of the meetings, and then they all evaporated. Where's the thousands and thousands and thousands of gun owners that should have been there? The thing is that zero. You couldn't find out why that is. All right. So the thing is that's why these guys are strutting around, because they're allowed to fire at you, and they're very sure you're never going to fire back at them.
Jeffrey, this is Doug. I've got a question for you. Okay.
Yes.
You talked about the John Birch Society attacking you and the founders of American Free Press. As I recall, it in the old days, since I was a Bircher for 16 years, from 66 to 82, they were also using the spotlight, the forerunner of American Free Press, to attack your organization and you. And so my point is, they taught us we should never go in the streets and picket, because that's the left that does that. They neutralized us by saying, let's just write letters. What good is writing letters do? Nothing.
Yeah,
so I finally wised after 16 years and decided to leave the Bird Society. But we have a lot of listeners on the program here that are supporters of the John Birch Society. So you please tell people a little bit more about the Birch Society, how I learned and you know this controlled opposition, please.
Well, first of all, this is my experience, okay? Remember, this is my long experience, but it is my experience. People are free to deal with this. But the thing is that in my experience, and, you know, I used to go up to the God, Family, and Country Rally in Boston, Massachusetts in 1968, 69, 70, 71. You know, that was Adam McKinney and Colonel Lawrence Bunker, you know. And I remember sitting with Phyllis Schlafly up there, and what a nice lady. And the thing is, you know, and all the wonderful patriots who are up there, and many, many of the people that were sincere Birch Society members. And you have to understand that there were major Birch Society members up there. Now, the Birch Society, number one, wanted nothing to do with racism or bigotry or that kind of thing. And that's entirely okay for them to make that basic decision. They want to go in that direction. That's fine, okay? But, of course, then they began to attack other patriotic leaders and other patriotic organizations, okay, either by rumor-mongering or outright open attacks or, you know, this kind of thing. Now, the thing is that, but in talking to them for many years, and there are times when I was alone with Robert Welch in his office speaking to him, and many other leaders that I met during the years where I'm alone talking with them, and you know, nobody is in the room with me, and, you know, in exploring their actual thinking, the core belief, the most cherished belief of the Birch Society for years was not anti-communism and was not anti-internationalism. The thing is that the core belief and the most cherished belief of the Birch Society, at least its major leaders, was that the Jews and only the Jews belonged in Palestine. They basically, that was the belief that if you contradicted or you questioned or you said, well, all you had to say is, well, what about the rights of the Palestinians? That's all you had to say. And you were immediately the devil. The reaction was very difficult to describe how violent and how upset they would get. But it was, I mean, just the facial expressions and the words and this kind of, you know. And at that time I had a radio show called American Outlook, which was on every week in New York City. It was creating a lot of interest, okay? At that time we had a gentleman on there I interviewed. I was the first one to interview Bob Depew after he got out of prison. I interviewed Ken Duggan, who was later strangled in the New York City jail, the most major patriot in New York to be killed under very strange circumstances. But that was during the days of, you know, during the days of COINTELPRO and domestic spying, where they could do whatever they wanted, really. I mean, CIA domestic was running all over New York, and, you know, with all the intelligence was in, I mean, some of these federal agencies were far more, you know, paranoid and interested in not only surveilling but interfering with and stopping patriotic movement people than the communists or anything like that. I mean, the communists were just a given entity, and they didn't react very strongly. At the height of the Vietnam War, all these Vietnam anti-war organizations, yes, they got infiltrated them, and yes, they tried to short-circuit them, but nothing compared. If you just said that there was a right-wing radical group running around Manhattan, the reaction to that, both by the New York City government, the state police, and the feds, was far, far more strong than reactions to the left wing. They were simply more comfortable with that. And the thing is that, well, why not? Because that's basically a product of the establishment. So the thing is that I found through all my years that the core belief of the Birch Society is the supremacy of Israel in that part of the world. And the thing is that people may argue for that or against that, but they never advertised that, and you know, to their membership, okay? But certainly I feel that was the core driving element in their thinking, and outside of that, and the anti-communism and later anti-internationalism was a much more surface belief and activity of theirs. So the thing is that there may have been a very good reason why they were attacking everybody that they considered something that should not be part of the patriotic movement, who elected them, I want to know. And they just operated as thuggies, really, in terms of just going after everybody they didn't like. Now, there's been, of course, with the Tea Party, there was a resurgence of their activity, including here in New York, and you know, and once again, there's a lot of front organizations that may not be exactly members of theirs, but they parallel them in activity. Okay, so you have a lot of birch-like groups that are out here, and they basically seem to have the same structure of belief, but also the same old bad structure of behavior, right? Including attacking other patriots. So the thing is that these are this is very, very disturbing. What's now started to happen. Now with the decline of the Tea Party, things have gone quiet again. You know, but as I said to you, that's the thing. You know, it's the persistency of action, yes, but it's how much you get into the public consciousness, and how what you place in the public mind, and how irreversible that is. Your actions, and also basically what you motivate people to do. And the thing is, that's really the measure. And you need both album makers and hit makers to do that. And I guess I'm being redundant in saying that. Back to you.
Jeffrey, we've got a caller that's got a hand up. They actually raised their hand earlier but then dropped off before we got to them. I also want to warn Red. Red, when I'm through with this caller, I'd like to let you get in here a little bit. Red, of course, has been one of the favorite poster children of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and certainly has had his run-ins with the ADL over the years. And so, Red, I want you to be able to jump in a second, but is it okay if we take a call now, Jeffrey?
Yes, certainly.
Area code 907, that's Alaska, I believe. You have an open mic.
Hello.
Hello. You introduce yourself.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
loud and clear.
Oh, my name is Brian. I used to live in Alaska, and I knew Schaefer Cox for years. And I guess is this just the subject on the, or is it I just call in and I was calling about Schaefer Cox. I've known him for many years. And I'm part of his defense. And I was just going to get up and say that Mr. Cox was in my living room talking to me and consulting with me about people in his militia movement behind him that were provoking him into doing these atrocities, actually, you know, to the judges, et cetera, up there. And he was being pressured into that, and he wanted me to set him up with a judge that I knew because he only lived a couple hundred yards from this Alaska judge. And I thought, well, yeah, I'll tell him, because he didn't think appropriate at the time to go to this judge's house. So he goes through me and tells me that what's going on behind the scenes, and I was going to stand up in court and tell all this stuff that Schaefer Cox told me and a witness in my living room. Also was heard all this Schaefer was going on. Schaefer was scared of his own militia.
Yeah.
And
well, they had infiltrators in there. Brian, I don't know if it's we're kind of getting off topic to what we're talking about at the moment, but next week, Brian, you'll want to be sure to call in here. We're going to have the Larry Pratt's going to be on with us. We've done a couple of shows on Schaefer, you know, over the last few weeks. And we're going to be doing
some more.
So anyway,
I was never called as a, to make a long story short, I was never called as a witness. And I will next. So I'm out here helping Schaefer Cox. So anyway, sure, I'll call next week. I got an email and it said call this number. So I did. And so I will later on. I'll have the number.
Good. And Brian, join the conversation. The last hour of our show next week will be focused on Schaefer. Please call back in. We're talking a little bit about it tonight, and we're out. My questions were going to go with Jeffrey here in just a moment. Really, it falls back to and connected to Schaefer's case, because what's happening, and let's just go there now, Jeffrey. Stay on with us, Brian. Let me direct this a little bit, and we'll get you back in here in just a second, okay? Hang on with us. Jeffrey, one of the things that I was going to ask you was to explain to the folks what the gun grab now is really about and what the source of that gun grab is. I know that you've written on the UN and you're obviously familiar with really the underlying conspiracy, which does exist, that's been playing out over the last 100 years. And in Schaefer's case, they're setting a precedent, a court precedent, that would allow them to prosecute every gun owner in America. And we're going to talk more about this next week. But, Jeffrey, if you would, just for a second, tell the folks what your research has shown as to the true source of this gun grab.
Well, first of all, you know, during this latest round of nonsense about what went on, first of all, the original incident was never properly investigated, just like 9/11 was never properly investigated. There are people that have tried to poke into it. There are now claims that these people are being harassed. That's very, very, very disturbing. But the thing is that, first of all, you know, I had a whole series of conversations with a gentleman. And of all the gun groups that I have seen, or groups that are looking to safeguard the rights of Americans, I must tell you that the group that I found most promising is called the GRAA, the Gun Rights Across America Group, the Eric Greed Group. You can Google him. GRAA, he's right on the web. Eric Reed, who is an airline pilot, by the way. And the thing is, he's had a series of rallies, but he puts together very intelligent rallies and very intelligent literature that not only goes out to the gun owner community, but goes out to the general public and explains the gun owner community in a way that it's absorbable in a positive way to the general public, in a way that a lot of groups... And there's a lot of groups basically out here that just have gun owners talking to other gun owners, and they form the classic containment vessel around them. So they're encapsulated, effectively, okay? There are people, however, who don't want to be in a phone loop, but want to be broadcasting to the general public and to everybody who listen. And the GRAA is that way. But in going around and investigating what happened after the events in Connecticut, I started to trip over people who are basically based in, of all places, London. And it seems to be, excuse me, hold on, please. Yes, what happens was that I began to trip over a British presence. And these people seem to be giving directions to the various gun control organizations or gun control advocacy organizations, as if they seem to be directed by this one organization, and it's based in London. And it's called IANSA. It's based in London, and it's Crown-financed. It's financed by the British Crown. What? What? This is a Crown organization that's seeking to reach into America and modify American rights and the structure of American law. And people sit here, and there are gun owner organizations that know all about this and are dismissive about this. Or they know about it, and they haven't let their members know about it. And we ask them why that is the case. They won't tell you why that's the case. Right? There is an absolute there's a hands-off New York attitude among a lot of patriotic organizations. You know, oh, we won't go there. Oh, we don't want to, like that. Well, there's a hands-off attitude towards London at the highest reaches of certain patriotic organizations. And that's sure true about this IANSA group. All right? Now, how come the average gun owner hasn't heard about this? All right? Forget it. You can't get a straight answer about that on any level of the so-called patriotic movement. Why is that? Why is that? So I'm sorry. You know, there's something very, very, very wrong here when the basic core centers where the basic sources of your problem are immediately off the top. There's an agreement not to bother them. Why is that? Listen, if somebody's shooting at you, all right, what if there's a bank robbery, starts shooting at the police, and the police have a rule they can never return fire ever? Well, very, very soon. There'd be bank robberies on every street corner. Yes, there would. And the thing is that it's the same thing here. We can't possibly win unless we direct at least some effective fire to the source of where this is all coming. Well, where is this coming from? Listen, your problems aren't coming from Bismarck, North Dakota. They're not coming from Pascagoula. They're not coming from Mississippi. They're not coming from, Sarasota, Florida. They're not coming from San Diego, guys. They're coming from two places. They're coming from the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and they're coming from London. And anybody who says that that ain't true is out of it. All right? Yes, there are academics on various campuses making policy. Yes, there are organizations like, the Metropolitan Council of Governments on the campus of Chicago University. Yeah, I know that, okay? Academia is involved in the deployment of people who are making policy and getting policy passed. I agree with that. That's all over the country. But the basic drive mechanism and the centrics that drives all this is basically between 42nd Street and 86th Street on the east side or in London.
Jeffrey.
So, go ahead.
The reason we've got those people in academia is because the tax-exempt foundations that have been controlled by Upper Manhattan and London, just like you said, they had a conspiracy that they put forward right through those tax-exempt foundations back in the 40s and 50s that played out, that gave them control of our education system. It was not by accident that they did that. It was a part of their plan all along to take control of our education system. And they've infiltrated that education system substantially. And that's why we've got these groups on our campuses.
That is absolutely 100% true, that this is part of a orchestrated, carefully planned, extremely well-financed program, okay, by the world's most evil people. Of course, it's a bunch of bankers and a bunch of occultists, okay, and who are totally mad. And the thing is that, that's certainly true. And the tax-free foundations are integral to, they are the basic financial delivery system that keeps, that visibly keeps these people afloat. Do I think it's the only thing that's keeping them financially afloat? No, I think there's massive money under the table, but you can never prove that, okay? But, or it would be difficult. But the bottom line is that having known that, and of course patriots have known that for many, many years now, the question is, what do you do about that? Here we are at this stage in history. We have advanced cancer in this country. What are we going to do? Continue to use aspirin on it? Well, then we're going to die, okay? All I'm saying is are you going to flood the body with aspirin? Or are you going to flood the body with, something that is strong enough and comprehensive and sophisticated enough to control the cancer and not kill the patient? And you also want to inject it in the areas of the centers. If there is a cancer in one place that's metastasizing all over the body,
okay.
You want to obviously flood the body with the suppressants for that activity, but you also want to inject a poison for the cancer into where the cancer is based. Okay? And if you don't do both of those things, you're going to lose the patient. Now, the thing is, this is basic physiography 101. We're not talking about something that's disputable here. So the thing is that, yes, you need action all over the country, but at some point, sometime, somebody is going to have to take legal, appropriate action where the problem is coming from. Now, what happens was that even though I disapproved of a lot of it, one of the things that happened, of course, in the last few years is Occupy Wall Street. Now, Occupy Wall Street actually was an amalgam of everybody that didn't like the banks, from the far right to the so-called far right to the so-called far left. Okay, there was a large patriot element that unfortunately dropped out after a while, and that left the movement susceptible to all kinds of attack. And a lot of the people that were in there were like new left people that dropped out of the new left because they realized it was controlled somehow, and they kind of wandered around without doing anything, and they finally joined this. Okay, fine. But something interesting happened. One night, the cops beat up a bunch of OWS people in San Diego, okay? They just wantonly beat them, okay? No doubt about it. What happens was that became known in New York. The group in New York went on a march up to City Hall, fine. But then they went on a march up into Soho, where these morons, like this woman that just hung herself, are paying $7 million for an apartment, okay? You know. And the thing is that, of course, now they're bothering all the ultra-wealthy yuppies, okay? Well, what happened was the town, Bloomberg, and everybody in position went temporarily crazy the next day, okay? The harassment dramatically increased the minute they touched that sensitive area. But OWS, because they weren't the old left, they didn't know about the rules. And you see, there are rules where you can march in Manhattan, okay, where you can have a mass demonstration. The left has been doing, from the Vietnam War on, the left has been marching up 6th Avenue to City Hall, from the village to Central Park, and then marching back down. They've been doing this for 40 years. Nobody cares. OWS didn't know about those rules, okay? So what did they do? They marched up 5th Avenue, right? And when they got to 13th Street, all these streets, they marched across. Hey, those are the streets where you have all these Illuminati guys living. That's where all these NGO people are and these bankers are with their $10 million condos. And what happens is that, of course, when they got to the end of the street, they kettled them, they got them into a street, they closed off the street, and the cops just went around macing people, okay, including the famous thing where they were macing women. All right, well, they hacked in, and they found the cop's name, who ordered this, and they went after him legally and that thing. But something else happened. But the fact that the police reacted almost in a panic condition the minute they touched certain streets in Manhattan where certain people lived, the fact that there was a demonstration coming down the street, and especially because some of the signs said, order the Fed, okay? I mean, the lead group that went over this Brooklyn Bridge that caused the mass arrest were order the Fed group. They were leading the march. Did you hear about that? Of course not. All right. The bottom line is the police went bananas. And that's because Bloomberg's agents, the people who are his middle management, who were there directing the police actions, went bananas the minute they touched certain streets, which every activist in New York knows. You can't march down those streets or cause any disturbance on the streets because who lives there? All right. Now, the thing is that all of that was highly significant. The fact that you had something happen around the country and it resulted in something happening in Midtown Manhattan was one of the most significant events, even though the people who were attacked maybe not be palatable to everyone or semi-palatable. You know, I've got my problems with some of the people who were in that park. That's certainly true. But the bottom line is that at least immediately there was a reaction where the orders are coming from. Okay? And the thing is that what if you had that with Gordon Call? Okay? You know, what if you had that with any of these outrages around the country where, you know, the reason why this is going on is because these people are well assured of one thing, that they can hurt anybody, put anybody in jail, kill anybody, and on and on and on. How many patriots have been killed so far? Gazillions. How many patriots have been locked up on crazy, silly charges? Gazillions. In my life, to 1965, how many patriots have been given long sentences? And I mean, guys who are total klutzes that are no danger to anyone, you know? Still, some prosecutor will lock on to them. But there's a reason for that, because the kind of NGOs that were driving Justice Department policy, you know, there is never any light shined on them. And we're talking about legal action here, and we're talking about simple exposure. But there's never any effort to expose. And among a lot of these patriotic groups through the years, through all of my years of activism, it's been the same glum effect. Where you talk to patriotic leaders, and they're interested in doing local action, they're interested in they're interested in writing books, they're interested in having meetings, writing letters, and on and on and on. But the thing is that when you say to them, well, gee, you know, you've got all these organizations in New York, why don't we mount a demonstration there? Right away, there's a thing, have a march on Washington, never go to New York, and never mention London. I mean, they don't mention the pilgrims. Do you know, anybody who know who the pilgrims are? I bet very few do, okay? I mean, you can't save a patient this way. If a patient's got advanced cancer, you've got to get something that, number one, floods the body, that prevents further metastasis of cancer, and then you've got to go to the center of cancer, and you've got to find some way of killing it. Okay.
Let me try to draw a connection here, because, you know, if I say to half of the patriots out there, if I say to certainly to anybody in the general public, what's the connection between the anti-gun legislation and Common Core? The odds are they're not going to see any connection between them at all. But in fact, they're the same cancer. And that's really right, it brings it back. And I muted Brian. Brian, I muted you because of the background noise. If you want to come back on, you'll have to hit a one twice probably to re-raise your hand, and then I'll know you're ready to talk again. But Schaefer Cox's situation that Brian brought up is a part of that same cancer. It's being fomented by those same people in Upper Manhattan and in London, because they have to drive a stake into the heart of the working class of America before they can have their full control that they want over this one world government and one world religion that they want to put into place. The number one thing stopping them, it's like hypochlorous acid in the body kills pathogens. Well, the fact that the working class of America is fully armed and ready to defend itself is the equivalent of that hypochlorous acid fighting that cancer. And if they can't take our guns away, they will never be able to do to us what they did to the people in Germany and in Russia and in other places, China and other places where tyranny has come in and controlled around the world. And they know that. So it's like one of the final phases of what they've been working on since this country really started, but it really escalated starting when the Federal Reserve took control of our money and they were able to then purchase this tyranny and bribe people and threaten people because of the money they were stealing from the working class through the taxing banking vortex that they started with the Federal Reserve and the income tax. So now we've got a case with this guy Schaefer Cox, this kid, this young man, this great statesman out of Alaska. They come against him, and they put charges on him that they could put on any of us and prosecuted him railroaded him and threw him in jail and are setting a precedent. Let me tell you what their conspiracy was based on. Listen to this closely. There was two elements of their conspiracy against him. One was that he believed in the Second Amendment, and the other element was that he could carry out his beliefs of defending our republic and our Constitution because he had guns in his home. Those were the elements that put him away for 27 years. Now, how many of us could be put away for the same reason? That's my question. And it's a part of the same cancer from the same source that's doing Common Core. There's people that are out there that are doing the pedophilia and stealing kids that Doug and them have been working so hard against. He'll be doing a show with David Schroeder tomorrow night on Crusade Radio that'll be talking about this very same subject, because they've brainwashed people and they abuse people, and they don't care about the life or Yahweh, our creator. They want to be gods, and that's the major part of this cancer. That's the cause of this cancer, are these people who want to be gods, and that's who you're talking about in Upper Manhattan and in London. Now, I'll get off my soapbox and let you come back in, Jeffrey, but I wanted to draw that connection together so that people realize that the Endangered Species Act is a part of the same cancer. The Wildlands Project is a part of the same cancer. Agenda 21 is a part of the same cancer that is trying to take our guns away from us today. And they're going to do it in the same way they did it against Schaefer Cox.
Well, let me ask you a little question. Let's say somebody came up to your house with a muzzle-loading gun, maybe a .72 caliber or something like that. Let's say that in the barrel he had a ball, but the ball had facets on it. It was cut like a diamond, so that a round cut diamond, like a ball, but it had, instead of having a smooth surface, it had different surfaces cut into it. Okay? Now he fires it at you. And one facet of the ball is the first thing that strikes your head and kills you. He goes to somebody else's house, and he lowers another ball with facets on it. He waits. He sees somebody through a window, or a poor woman, fires it, and the first thing that hits her head is a facet, okay, another facet, okay, but it's the same ball and it's the same shooter, okay? The thing is that people have got to understand that the thing that's attacking us is like a hydra. It has many heads, but it has one body and one heart, and it has one food source. Now, you find a way to take the food source away by seriously interfering with the banking, or you got to do something about the animal, unless you want to die, because you all are going to die if something is not done about this animal soon. Okay? Period. End of story. Things are getting worse. They're not getting better. There is an absolute correction. Why? Because the financial structure, the banks, money into the tax-free foundations that fund all these different efforts. And it's like a ship. It's like a warship. And there's a communications room. There's a small arms room. There's a larger room for shells. There is a room for intelligence gathering. Each room is doing a different thing, but it's the same damn ship, and it's sailing right towards you, and it wants to sink you. Well, what do you think you should do? Do you should think you should, I think I'll fire into this room or that room on the ship, or do you want to sink the whole ship? Look, there are people who will look at a garbage can, and they'll say, well, you know, I wonder what activity is in there. Who controls the garbage can? All right, do the red rats control the garbage can? Blue rats, do the insects control certain parts of the garbage can? Listen, there's one thing to do with the can, flood it with water, flood the can. Because everything in there is a contaminant. And only by stopping, only by understanding that this is a hydra, but it does have a body. It does have a central control. And you've got to get to that central control or deprive the central control of a physical base, a safe physical base, where they aren't so sure of themselves and they can't do whatever they want. Now, obviously, when we're talking about that, we're talking about legal action, and we're obviously talking about, you know, reasonable legal action that would be acceptable to the general public, because if you do anything crazy, then you're easily depicted as a bad guy. But the thing is that I don't understand why there is silence. You know, I don't understand how they can be putting in this Agenda 21 thing all over the country, disrupting people, putting in this Common Core thing, and no one, I find no one getting in front of any meeting and simply giving out pungent enough literature to make a protest. I can tell you in the 60s and early 70s, there would be this. That has even declined. And the funny thing is that the Internet is hurting us in a lot of ways. Why? Because people sit there and they get more and more educated and they feel that they're the smart guy and everybody else is, you know, is a boob. And the thing is that they know, and now they're cool guys and they know what's going on. Well, that's really great, but let me tell you something. What the Internet is increasingly needing is the people that are educated, people that are very, very knowledgeable in the workings of this conspiracy, and they're effectively totally ineffective in terms of their transmittal to the public or making noise about it. And let me tell you something. When your country is in trouble, silence is treason. Too many people are effectively silent. I'm sorry. There should be screaming on every street corner in Manhattan over what's happening in this country, unless you want to lose your country. There should be screaming on every, there should be screaming bloody murder about, if you have a crown-based, crown-funded organization that's trying to reach in to America and change Americans' basic rights, if that's going on, why is it that there is a screaming all over the place for that? Why weren't there thousands of gun owners down at the United Nations? Why was there resistance in many gun groups against that? Explain that to me. Well, nobody can explain that to me. So something stinks here. Something's very, very wrong with our organization, very wrong with our leaders, and very wrong with our methodology. I'm sorry. You can't allow the enemy a peaceful, safe place to reside and fire missiles, and nothing is ever going to be done back. We're not talking about doing something improper. We're talking about basically depriving these people of a peaceful place to do whatever they want. Okay, physically challenging them. You know, in the old days, at least there would be people giving out literature, pungent literature. Okay, I'll tell you what. There was a play on Broadway. It's actually in a private club that was very blasphemous and really held the Holy Family in very great disregard. It was terrible. All right, and there was a protest that was mounted on that street in 52nd Street, which is part of the inner district, and they had a couple of thousand people there one night screaming bloody murder. And it sent a message. And the Broadway reporter who called me up, who covers Broadway, he said, well, you know, who started this thing? Well, I told him the whole story of how it was put together and why it was, because I was in charge of writing the literature, right? So he called me up. But I said, I fought with and disagreed with the leaders of the organization on a number of points. First of all, they should have started at 42nd Street. They should have wound through the streets of Broadway, including Schubert Alley. They should have caused a major unpleasant presence with all these morons that are paying $150, $200 for a seat to sit in these terrible plays they have now. And the thing is that, and then they should have ended up on 52nd Street. I would have inflicted a much higher level of insult, and you know, on the Broadway community for what you did, because there's an absolute atmosphere of license towards insulting anything that is either patriotic or God-based, you know, or family-oriented, you know. And the thing is that he was flabbergasted that I said that. I'm sure he reported what I said to the police. I could care less. But the bottom line is that that's the bottom, you know, they have to know that if they do something on Monday, on Wednesday there's going to be some major retaliation. All right? Now, OWS was 100% right in what they did with the San Diego beating of their members and then, you know, going on the warpath in Midtown Manhattan. They were absolutely right. What they were doing was legal. They were walking down the street. Some of them were shouting and holding signs, but they're going down these holy streets that there's now an unwritten rule that nobody can demonstrate on. How is that? How is that that you have certain areas in Manhattan now and certain areas in this country where demonstrations are just simply not allowed, or you'll be in big trouble if you do that? Explain to me how that came to be the rule. Well, that came to be the rule, first of all, in New York City, okay? And that was the rule before 9/11, okay? There was an unwritten rule with all these characters who, you know, a lot of these leftist organizations, the leaders lived off the organization very well, and they had foundation grants, which they didn't want to lose, so they knew damn well what they better do and what they better not do, okay? OWS didn't know that. They didn't care about that. They were too young. They were too inexperienced, and they just got on the wrong streets, and you saw the effect. But let me tell you what happened. So naturally, as a result of them marching in certain areas, the police, directed by Bloomberg, went on a rampage of illegal activities. Okay? Well, first of all, they started wantonly arresting people. And this wasn't the average cop. This was like superiors, you know, directed by Bloomberg aides. Okay. First of all, a lot of these kids learned to have a bloggy on them, you know, a digital video recorder. So every incident was covered in many different angles. The district attorney's office had to basically dismiss 200 to 300 felony indictments against marchers on the Brooklyn Bridge. Felony indictments they had to walk away from. You know why? Because all the illegal stuff that was done to the marchers, all right, was so plain on so many digital video recordings that were downloaded on YouTube that they couldn't get away from it. So they had to cut 200 to 300 people that they were trying to go after on major felony charges. They had to tiptoe away from that because they had bloggies on them. All right? Or the richer kids had that Go video, you know, where it's a recorder and the smaller your back and then you plug in whatever camera you want, or very high definition. Sure. They want to be dealing with those things in court when it gets to court. Forget the lawsuits that are going to be against New York City over this, what it's going to cost the taxpayer. Bloomberg's gone, and we're going to be saddled with the bill for all this nonsense he did. Right? But the thing is that they'd be in big trouble, except they had that bloggy on them, except they had that Go video on them, okay, to protect them. I'll tell you, that's those digital video recorders, they're better than 10,000 lawyers. All right, in terms of, it's a get-out-of-jail card, all right? And that all came to the fore on OWS, okay? That spread to the smarter people in the activist community. So the thing is that, but the bottom line is that, but the police were harassing, and Bloomberg was down there, his guys were down there directing what was going to be done. You had people from Homeland Security down there in the background giving their little orders, right? Okay, and it went on and on. Now, there were several hacker groups down there. Anonymous was the biggest, but they had two rivals to Anonymous down there. So a guy from one of the guys comes to me. He said, oh, you know what's happening? I said, what? They threatened Bloomberg that they were going to hack into his business computers, into his business computers, okay? Guess what? No, guess what? No, listen to me. Guess what happened the next day? The police harassment went down 80 or 90% in one day. The minute it was going to be his goddamn computers, they started, you know, that was the end, okay? I was there, I saw this, okay? So that's a little lesson for you, okay? Why? Because as long as these guys can, and I don't advocate what they were even threatening doing, okay? Because you know, the public isn't going to accept that, and the thing is that there's great moral and ethical questions about that. However, the thing is that the minute Bloomberg felt that something may be effectively coming back at him. And believe me, these kids, when they gang up their computers around the country, it's like a cray. That's how powerful it is. They can break into anything, all right? I don't care. And the thing is
there's got to be a backlash, Jeffrey. There's got to be a backlash every time Bloomberg sets his foot outside of his little territory up there. Everybody has to come and absolutely push him out of their states. That's what we did with our recalls here in Colorado, because we were fighting directly against him, and he got slapped right in the face. And this off-presidential year election is going to slap him some more, and we need to slap him as much as we can, and we need to also do some poll watching to make sure that they're not buying the votes with flipping the votes electronically. We've got we got another caller from area code 785 in Kansas. Can I take that call, Jeffrey?
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
Area code 785, you have an open mic. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you very much. I sat here and listened to a lot of symptoms of the problem that we have, but I haven't heard anything about how are we going to try to solve that problem. Have you got anyone that is on the line that can address that question?
Jeffrey, can I take the first shot at it, and then you can go?
Certainly, go ahead.
We've got to organize at the grassroots level. We've got to take control of our counties and our states before we can do anything at the what I call international level or federation-wide level. Each state, in fact, is a nation. The United States is not a nation, it's a federation. And we need to stop listening to the lies that we're getting from out of the upper Manhattan through Washington, D.C. and through the mainstream media. But we've got to organize at a level where we can start holding our government officials, all of those in public office, accountable. One of the places that I would recommend you go if you haven't already is to the All States Organic Initiative website, where you'll find an essay talking about boards of government review. This, we believe, is the one way that we will be able to have a true effect. There's a lot of people out there trying to do a lot of different things, and they're splintered. But we can pull people from various groups, whether it's Tea Party or 912 or We Are Change or you know, the Libertarian Party or GOP or whoever it is out there, and put together a nonpartisan government oversight group and organize county and state level. ASOI stands for All States Organic Initiative. That's ASOI.us. Go to that website and read the essay on that website several times. It will give you guidance as to how to organize in your own area and why you need to do it. No question, this is something anybody and everybody can participate in, and it will have an effect if we get this organized across our continent. But that's what it's going to take, because going and marching on Washington isn't going to cut the mustard, particularly not if you've got a Zionist-based group who's going unarmed. I mean, we've been there before. They're not even, you know, it's a federation-wide petition accomplishes nothing. We've been doing it since 1995 formally, and they just ignore it. So we've got to start holding our local and state officials accountable.
I've heard you talk about several different strategies that might be used, SOASI being one of them, and certainly Colonel Riley and taking a group to Washington under the auspices of OAS, I believe it is, and different things. These are strategies, and there's nothing wrong with having multiple strategies. But somewhere along the line, you have to focus on just how are you going to hold the criminals that are responsible for our condition accountable. And when you look at it realistically, and some of us have tried to do that, we concluded that you have very few options. That, number one, you could hold them accountable under the law if indeed you had access to the law to do that with. But unfortunately, the common law grand juries that are authorized by the Bill of Rights were taken from us in 1946 with the changes that were made in the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, where they declared them to be obsolete. So it's going to take state action, in our mind, to reinstate the viability of those common law grand juries if you're going to try to do it that way. The second option that you have, and by the way, you only have six boxes with which to solve
I gotta stop you for a second, okay? Have you gone and read the essay at ASOI.us?
No. Have you gone and read the essays on the CNC.org website?
Yes, I have. And I'm here to tell you that the whole grand jury concept out there, that where you've got citizens grand juries that are organizing them outside of the auspices of a court, is going to accomplish the same thing it's accomplished since the early 90s when all of these various ones have been formed, and that is you're going to frustrate the people, you're going to waste resources. You need to go and read that essay and understand the difference between a citizen's grand jury and a board of government review, because the grand juries have failed and they're going to fail, and it's going to waste resources. But if you put together a charter with the same effort that you can go and organize the people for the grand jury, if you go and organize a board of government review and charter it that way, you're going to be able to accomplish a lot more. You're not going to get people thrown in jail, and you're not going to waste those resources, and you're not going to deceive people the way that just what you said a while ago, the Bill of Rights, you said that the Bill of Rights authorizes a common law grand jury. Well, let me tell you something. A common law grand jury, that's the only kind of grand jury there is. The properly seated grand juries are common law grand juries, because once they're seated, those panel members have the right to judge the law. Now, I've got an expert online with me by the name of Red Beckman, who's helped form and was behind the formation of the Fully Informed Jury Association. And we've done a lot of shows here about grand juries. I happen to be a great supporter of the grand jury system, and I believe that people need to be fully informed. But when you go out there in an act of rebellion and insurrection against a legislated institution, without the auspices of a court, you have no ability to prosecute a subpoena, and you have no ability to prosecute, and you're classifying yourself somewhere down in the pecking order underneath the government and underneath the courts, where a Board of Government Review has the full power of the Article 61 Magna Carta group that forced the king to sign the Magna Carta. That was a Board of Review. That's not down under the Constitution or under the government in pecking order. It's under the Creator, and it is a collection of individual rights being applied. It basically is the same as the law itself, in that the law represents a collection of individual power, where the Board of Government Review represents that same full power of the individual people. So you need to go read that essay and understand it and stop deceiving people about what Scalia said in the 1992 Williams case. Scalia never, any time in that case or any other time, ever envisioned a grand jury being formed outside of the auspices of a court. It, he did not say that in that decision, and anybody that represents it, he said that in the decision, is deceiving people. So I thank you for your call.
I did not. Let me make something very clear to you. I did not say that I am in favor of common law grand juries. I said that that is one way in which people can try to do something. And if it gathers some people together who will then affiliate with other people on other strategies, I think it's a good move. And I'd like to say hi to Red, if I may. How you doing, buddy? I have known Red Beckman for many, many years. But if you're going to make even what you're talking about work, you're going to have an undeniable political force available to you to make their decisions stick and become meaningful. And so the questions come, what should that force look like? How should it be organized?
Go to that website. Your questions are answered in that essay and in the charter and in the orders that you'll find at the ASOI website. It's all there, laid out for you.
ASOI. Okay,
yes.
Let me take a look at it and see if it answers some of the questions that I then have. But I think you're right when you said it has to be a grassroots thing. It has to begin down at the zip code level probably, or even lower than that it could. And how do you get that force created? That's the real question. And singing off the same sheet of music and pursuing those same things. Well, I'll take
what's your
a look
first
at
name?
It. And
what's your
I'm
first
Walt.
Name? Walt. We have a call on Monday nights where we talk about this particular subject in detail. We've done a few shows here at Walls in Our Minds on it, but if you go to the website, the ASO website, and under the home button, the homepage button, you'll see that there is a weekly call. And I would welcome you to first read that essay, because your questions and comments on Monday night will be much more educated in the subject if you read that essay a few times. But I welcome you to call in on that Monday night call and join that conversation. It's from 7 to 9 Mountain or 9 to 11 Eastern, the same time as this is. And you can get all of that information in the call-in number. It's a free conference call, and there's a code on there to enter. But we would welcome you to come and join that discussion on Monday night.
Is that call-in number the same
Jeffrey,
as this
any
one
other
tonight?
Anything to add to what I said? I kind of got on my soapbox. I'm sorry.
No, what Bruce was saying is 100% correct. You need, there's two things here. Whatever you do must be effective. It must be simple. It must be energy efficient. It can't, the ratio of effort to results has got to be high enough, okay? It must be relatively simple. Why? Because otherwise you place yourself in a complex rat's maze, and you run them out inside the maze, and you self-contain yourself. There's a danger of that. The question is, how many people can you reach? How many heads can you get into? How many minds can you irreversibly change? And what effective action can you motivate them to take? That's the measure of whatever you do. Whatever you do, those are the standards by which it must be judged, because you don't have much time. I mean, this is not the 60s or 70s where you've got a long time for the country to decay. You're in a much, much, much more advanced state of decay now, okay? So the thing is that your efforts have got to be effective, and, again, it's got to be something where it's hard for them to retaliate on you, okay? Here in New York and in most urban areas, let's say you're a Mother Teresa and they can't criminally go after you. The next thing is they send IRS after you. Okay, let's say you're a trust fund baby and they can't do that. Well, the next thing is here comes the psychiatrist to say you're nuts. Okay? Now, what we had for many years in New York was a resident psychiatrist that both the left and the right went to. Whenever they were trying to frame you in a psych, he would show up and say, up, 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 up. I just examined this guy 3 months ago, and I did a forensic workup, and he was fine, you know? So Dr. Robert John probably saved hundreds and hundreds of people from being locked up in psychiatric facilities. But that's the order of attack, at least in most urban areas that I know of. And the thing is, you've got to be very careful of all that. You have to be legally bulletproof. You've got to be financially bulletproof. You know, it really helps if you're supported by other people and you have no legal income yourself, or you've got a trust fund. And the third thing is you've got to have a friendly psychiatrist to swear that you're not nuts. Otherwise, away you're going to go. Period, end of story, because that's the way they always do. I mean, there's a wonderful book that was written basically in the late 60s. It was called Destroy the Accuser by Fred Seelig, S-E-E-L-I-G, Fred Seelig, okay? Google the book. Fred Seelig. He was locked up in Springfield, and for many, many years, Springfield Mental Hospital was the end of the line for activists, both left and right in this country. If the government didn't like you, and you were really bothering somebody, you were going to end up in Springfield, and you were going to be forcibly medicated. Right? And that was just, there was a surge of that under Robert Kennedy, and later Nicholas Katzenbach, and eight years after that. So the thing is that this is the order of what goes on. As far as your activism, again, there's a lot of these systems through the years, and they've been a bright idea, and they were going to save everything, and they all petered out. And what you need is two things. You do need activism that will effectively interfere with the system and will be done in such a way that it is very, very difficult for them to retaliate and just simply arrest you or pull you in on a psych, okay, or have IRS go after you. The other thing is that you need that kind of activism, and you also need the street, okay, because when your country's under attack, nothing beats the street, at least in certain levels. You've got to have guys out there. You've got to have guys meeting the public, agitating, and recruiting people, okay? You need a membership chairman to bring the right people in and keep the wrong people out, okay? You need a finance chairman for contributions. You need a public relations, press relations guy, you know? And all these guys have got to be highly effective, they keep positions. But the thing is that you got to get out there, and somehow you got to get into the public consciousness in a positive way, in which you recruit these people and also motivate them to take effective action. And whatever plan you have, those are the standards that you've got to do. Otherwise, New York is going to laugh at you. And at some point, somebody's going to show up on the island of Manhattan, period, end of story. Otherwise, they're simply going to go on laughing at you, in my opinion.
Jeffrey, I have not let Red get in here for 1 minute. We've got about 2 minutes left. Red, I just want to make sure you know that we love you there. You haven't said anything tonight, and I don't know if you intended to, but I wanted to give you a couple of minutes here to close us out. Jeffrey, thank you very much for being our guest tonight. You've been a great guest. I want to thank Walt and Brian both for calling in, and all of our listeners. But Red, close out. You got 2 minutes.
Organization, and I don't care if it's a denominational religion, a political party, or whatever it is. That's the worst thing you can do, for the simple reason that your enemy is going to infiltrate, and they will. They're getting paid by the enemy to cause trouble. And so in Montana in 1980, I want to say it here real quick. In Montana in 1980, we had one state meeting. In Montana, the Montana Vigilantes is our history. They're the ones who brought law and order to Montana in 1861 and 2 and 3. and even into the early 1900s. And so we had a meeting. Statewide leaders wanted to get the Montana vigilantes working again. And I explained how that we had to do it on a three-man maximum in the organization. No more than three people. And you didn't have three people other than three people that had known each other for years. They were deer hunters. They were elk hunters. They worked together. They may have been brothers. They may have been cousins, whatever. But there was no organization above three. And that way, we had so many of them, the enemy could not infiltrate. And that is what terrorizes the enemy. And we didn't carry it far enough. We didn't get as far as we should have. But I'll have to bring that up later at another meeting. But anytime you get a group of people, a patriot group, you're going to have infiltrators coming from the enemy side. And you're going to have trouble. And I've seen it for all these years, and it's still there, still coming.
Thank you very much, Red. Thanks again, Jeffrey. We are out of time. We'll see you next week for Walls in Our Minds.
God bless America. That I hope would quench the burning of the thirst I felt within. Oh,
there.